Today I want to talk about the idea that we are programmed by birth. I think it's safe to assume that we are conglomerations of energy patterns arranged in certain ways. Obviously, there are differences between being a man and a woman, so we could say that, certain energy patterns are arranged differently in men than in women, and they actually have different energy patterns that are distinct for women that are not present in men, and vice versa. But this topic, programmed by birth, has two meanings that I'm going to address. It means that we can be programmed by the time we're born. So we're programmed already. And the other is, we are being programmed by that birth experience, that is, the labor and the emerging from our mother's wombs. And when you think about it, if we're programmed already, the arrangement of our energy patterns is, to a large extent, arranged before we start developing outside of our mother's wombs in life over the next 120 years. We know that our parents influence us in a lot of different ways. You and I are the same race that our parents are. The coloring that we have is probably similar to theirs. The blood type and other physical characteristics are essentially the same that our parents had. There's no real mystery there. We know that the maternal environment, that is where we're developing, can be made hospitable or inhospitable by what is going on in our mother's life, and the environments that are affecting her are actually affecting us. If we turn around and look at babies born to mothers who are depressed, and in the last couple of decades, they recognize, you know what? This baby is depressed. So the energy of depression and the way that is processed, those energy patterns are impressed onto the baby, and they're coming out depressed. Horribly, this idea of alcoholic mothers giving birth to babies that have the fetal alcohol syndrome, which says that they are coming out of the womb retarded because of being grown in the womb in an environment that is filled with a neurotoxin, alcohol. So there's no mystery now that a mother drinking significant amounts of alcohol is affecting that developing baby. The same with smokers, that whole idea. Years ago, I had a stepson who had various diagnoses, brain damaged, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, depending on who was talking to him. So I would attend some meetings that were devoted to children and parents of kids with disabilities of a variety of sorts. And I noticed that there were a lot of older people. I mean, we're talking like 45, 50, even older people that had children at a very late age. And it's recognized now that babies born to older parents can have genetic damage that results in retardation of various categories. And anybody who remembers thalidomide or DES or other pharmaceuticals recognize that not only illnesses and vaccinations and pharmaceutical use during pregnancy can harm the unborn child. So we think, you know, if a mother's depression can be communicated to an unborn child, why don't we consider that there are whole lots of different energy patterns that could be communicated to the unborn child? Why would we be surprised that the general emotional states of the mother and the baby are very similar? They're fitting into the world. Well, why wouldn't we consider those? Oh, well, that certainly makes sense, go hand in glove. Why would we be surprised if a mother was withdrawn from her baby and then the baby indicated tendencies to be withdrawn too? An area of medicine that has really grown tremendously in the last number of years has been brain seizure research. And one of the horrifying things discovered in this research is that humiliation can actually cause a child's brain's growth to be stunted. We could stunt the growth of a child's brain by humiliating that child. Said another way, that the energy of words, sights, and sounds sent to, received, and accepted by a child can cause brain problems to the physical organ, the brain. That's unbelievable and horrifying at the same time. But now that that's known, what would make us think that words, sounds, and sights experienced by the mother and the baby don't affect them both? And with the baby, of course, being the most vulnerable, because there's no way to make sense of that stuff. The baby is not able to deflect any of that, or this was not about me. That means the baby would be most at risk, more than even the mother. Here's a problem with the human race. Maybe it's a big problem. It's largely overlooked, and maybe for many people it's not understood at all, is we don't understand the power of the word. The word. Now, a moment ago I said we can humiliate a child with words and affect its brain's ability to grow. So that seems pretty powerful, doesn't it? That's unbelievably powerful. But we throw words around like they mean nothing or have no real value or no impact on the sender or the receiver. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can never hurt me. That is so false. That is so false. That's back from the era where people went, you know, I can't see a word, but I definitely can see a stick and stone, and I can definitely see an impact of a stick of stone when it hits a person's body. So I guess that's the real danger. But now, over time, the real danger is not the stick and stone. The real danger are the words. When you think of words having a great deal of power, it's the meaning of the words on the part of the recipient. And, of course, the sender could deliberately mean this word to hurt another person. You know, when we insult somebody deliberately, we're not trying to be funny, even though we may pretend that. We're looking to deliver pain. So if it's going to a innocent child, that's bad news. So words can mean a great deal, and we give them meaning, and this is one of the great areas of power for human beings. We can give any kind of meaning we want to any energy exchange experience. We could see something, and somebody goes, oh, that's painful. No, that's growthful. That was interesting. That was developmental. That was, and we could make up all kinds of things. And somebody else says, oh, that was pleasant. They go, oh, no, that wasn't. That was embarrassing. It was terrible. It was soul damaging. It was like, huh? We make up the meanings. So if we think that these words that we're speaking to ourselves and to others are just maybe noise, we are missing the point. A lot of different college football games were played yesterday, and a lot of professional football games are going to be played today. So just think of a pep rally. All the words and the sights and the sounds that go into a pep rally, you know, rah-rah cheering and all the cheerleaders and everybody else cheering the team on. Why? Because they're using these words and these sounds and these sights in order to energize, to strengthen, to empower their team versus the other team. And most of us already know this, that words delivered cruelly embarrassingly, shockingly, can disempower and deflate a person. Sometimes just temporarily, but even permanently, as I mentioned in terms of the humiliation on a child's brain. If we appreciated the causative power of our words, we would definitely be wiser in our use of them. Scientology emphasizes that during childbirth, it should be completely silent. No words are to be spoken because they recognize that they don't want to be in this moment of physical discomfort for the mother and for the baby. They don't want to do any kind of programming of the baby or the mother. And when you add words to something that is emotionally or physically painful, those events result in deep programming. So we do know that lots of meanings can be communicated with words and even without words. Every child learns to recognize the look. The look, that's the image of displeasure on the face of a parent or another authority figure. Just that, right? The look. We know that certain music energizes us, and other music can evoke emotions of sadness. You get certain things, and it's like, oh, wow. Oh, I feel so sad. Oh, it's so evocative. Oh, right? We know that. Nobody is playing John Philip Sousa's marching music during a funeral. And nobody is playing a funeral dirge during a halftime show of a professional sporting event. It's like, no, why would you do that? We would maybe reverse that. Oh, why? Because we know that those energy patterns have an impact on human beings and their emotional states. Since everything is energy, and the only difference in things is the frequency and amplitude of the energies, right? We look around and go, oh, I got a bunch of solid stuff here. I'm looking at a computer. I'm looking at software, looking at telephones and a microphone and headset and chair and table and walls and cabinets. And the difference between them and the air in between us is the frequency and the amplitude of the energies. So that being said, we can accurately continue and say, we are programmed by energy, with birth being one phase of our lives during which a tremendous amount of programming occurs. We are programmed by birth. So let's just take a look at this idea of when programming occurs. I'm talking about birth, but you know what? You know, it extends before birth and after birth. So let's look at what I consider to be some distinct phases that might be convenient for detecting when we were programmed. Now, I've made these up, you know, they're commonly thought of, but it would be very easy to say, no, there's way more than seven, or no, you know, those seven are too elaborate, let's reduce that number. So it's arbitrary, right? But I say, let's start with conception. Conception. Now, even though conception doesn't result at the time of intercourse, it's not like, okay, we're making love, boom, and when we get out of bed, we've got a fertilized ovum. That doesn't exactly happen that way. But the energy of the participants in that activity do deliver, because those energies persist, they do program the soon-to-be fertilized ovum. So the attitude, the mindset of the male and the mindset of the woman in that activity are significant. Some people want to get pregnant, and they can approach their lovemaking with a whole variety of positive attitudes. Joyful expectancy, you know, the great opportunity that of being loving and helping and nurturing and caring for this baby, and on and on and on. Or for people who are struggling to have children, that, you know, that lovemaking could be filled with desperation. Oh, we're trying so hard. And those are just a couple of examples, and there are, of course, a wide range of feelings that could be involved in that process. Some people don't want to get pregnant at all, but irresponsibility and not having a choice are just two examples of that attitude, right? Like, I don't want to pray. I don't. Whoops, too late. The second phase that I'm talking about in this process of programming after conception is gestation. And it's just about 9 months, 39 weeks of pregnancy, during which the mother's experiences of energy exchange will be affecting the developing child. What the mother sees and hears and feels and senses and smells and tastes and touches, all of those things are being energetically delivered to the baby. When the mother has discomfort and negative feelings about that discomfort, and maybe the cause, oh, this is awful to be pregnant, it's awful to be pregnant, it's terrible to be pregnant in the summertime. I can recall hearing that from the mother of my children, and it certainly made sense to me. But she wasn't only talking to me, she was talking to herself and she was talking to the babies. And those negative feelings, of course, are being sent inward, not just outward. If the mother has shame for being pregnant, has worries about being able to care for a child, or anxieties about finances, or even bringing the child into this world, this is such a terrible world, you know, I don't want to bring a child into this world, I wouldn't wish this on anybody. All of that stuff is going to be added to the child's programming. The third phase I identified is labor. This is when programming of the child is even more intensely done, it seems to me. When my children were born, it wasn't permitted for the father to be present. So I'm speaking largely from lack of experience. But I know what labor's like from the outsider's point of view, of course, and there has to be fear, pain, uncertainty, self-doubt, lack of trust, probably many more emotions being experienced by the mother. And today, you can add in the father. So now the fathers are standing there having all of this stuff, and, oh, what did we do? This is awful. And then you add in all the energies that are being experienced by the attending staff of medical personnel. All of those things are bombarding this whole field in which this baby is being born or about to be. It amazed me some years ago when I read a medical survey of doctors that identified the reason for the increase of cesarean sections, babies born by cesarean delivery as compared to natural birth. Here's the major factor that was identified: the anxiety level of the doctor. Like, what about the baby? It's the anxiety level of the doctor. What about the mother? It's the anxiety level of the doctor. Like, whoa. I found that disturbing. So I was in the labor room for one of my children's pregnancies, and it was busy. It was official. It was, we're getting ready for the next phase kind of place. It was not warm, and it was not welcoming. It was sterile in both senses of the word. There was nothing sacred. There was nothing miraculous. There was nothing even special in the way that that labor was handled in the labor room. It was just about processing a pregnant woman. And, you know, if it was preparing a car to be spray painted, or getting a meal ready for a diner out in the restaurant eating area, like, this is just about processing. The amount of time in labor, the thoughts and feelings, words and sights experienced by the mother are primed for programming a child. Fearful mothers, lengthy labors, uncertainty, holding back, all impact the baby. I've had clients who were born to mothers who had stillborns or miscarriages. And so mothers who had stillborn prior to a live birth, I've got to have a crushing amount of fear and doubt during labor. Afraid to push for fear of another dead baby extends that labor and programs that baby, based upon what I've seen, into hesitancy and impulsivity. And I can't do it, and then becoming impulsive all of a sudden. Resistance to having a baby and resistance to being born, yeah, two points of view, can intensify and lengthen that labor. And when you think about the rest of our lives, which is essentially the same as being born, right? Entering a new space or doing new things or taking new jobs or meeting new people or all of those things are like, oh, I'm coming into a new space. This is, you know what? This is kind of like a birth process. And if my point of view is valid, it would say that it is likely that the attitudes and the energy patterns that we acquire during the birth process are the same ones that are going to be impacting us as we engage in new activities. We're going to either embrace them or retreat from them or withdraw from them or delay them or fill in the blank. The next phases of life and programming that I described are the birth itself, and right after birth, when the baby is disconnected from the mother and taken away to be measured and processed and cleaned up and then brought back to the mother. And then some people believe that the next 36 months are, in terms of creating the self-esteem of this new little physical being, are the most important time. 36 months, first 3 years of life. Well, if you add in the first 9 months and the labor and delivery and the first 36 months, you're basically talking less than 4 years that shapes everything that's going to occur for the next 117 years. That's significant. We need to be paying attention to that sort of thing. So if there's a lot of self-esteem being delivered or developed by the energies being delivered in that first 36 months, we go like, oh boy, we got to pay attention here. Now, I personally think from a conscious standpoint, you got to extend that time frame out to about 12 years. But subconsciously, I'm okay with the idea that during that first 36 months outside of the mother is when we're being programmed subconsciously to a great extent, and how we feel about ourselves is going to be largely shaped at that point. How we relate to other people and, you know, peers and parents and siblings and whomever, I think then we got to start looking for the first 12 years of life. The pain of birth is known to mothers, right? Everybody else may talk about it, including myself. But mothers know what an experience that is because they were there for it. But we don't know much about or anything about how painful birth is to the baby. Until recent decades, doctors, most of whom were men, like, oh, the babies don't have any feelings. No. Babies, they're little, I don't know what, little teeny packages of meat. They don't feel anything. That's known to be completely false now. Babies do experience pain during labor and birth. It's like, yeah. We know this kind of process or pattern occurs immediately after delivery. The gender is known. If it wasn't known before by tests, now it is known. In some cases, the baby is a disappointment, so that energy of disappointment is transmitted right to that child. If it was a girl and they wanted a boy, or if it was a boy and they wanted a girl, boom, I'm a disappointment. Programming occurs. In some countries on Earth, being born a girl is essentially a death sentence. We don't want that. And even more countries, being born a girl is really to be consigned to second-class status. less than, not enough. It's like, really? And it's known that physically, emotionally, mentally, and spiritually is certainly not true, but politically, that seems to be the norm. The next check of that newborn after gender is to, like, okay, let me see if it's normal. And the relief of discovering 10 little teeny miraculous fingers and 10 little teeny miraculous toes and 2 arms and 2 legs and a normal face and head bring tremendous relief to the parents. But in those cases where that doesn't happen, the overwhelming heartache is now transmitted to that child. One of the programming issues that I've come across has to do recently with fitting in. Fitting in, you could say, wow, that's a broad concept. You could talk about that for hours. Sure, we could. But this idea, will this child fit in? Will this child fit in into the family structure? You know, we have this many bedrooms, this many beds, this much financial ability, this much time, this much space. Just will the baby fit in? In utero, and I've seen this, I've seen huge fathers, you know, 6'5 fathers with 5 foot tall mothers. I'm going, whoa. Will that baby even fit in to the baby and to the mother's body? You know, what is that going to be like? What's that going to be like for that baby to fit into the mother's life once it's born, into the mother's activities? If this is a professional woman with other responsibilities for a whole bunch of other kids or a job or a career, how is that baby going to fit in? And we know that at some level, labor starts automatically when the baby no longer fits in. Something gets triggered, unless the labor, of course, is induced medically. But under normal circumstances, something happens to the mother's body that's like, okay, time's up. Let's start using contractions and these rhythmic waves to move this baby out. It no longer fits in. The baby is full term. Okay, got it. And labor can be prolonged because a larger baby doesn't really fit into the birth canal of a smaller woman. And okay, oh my God. And then, if you really want to get complicated, you could say that, hey, positioning of the baby, head first, that didn't occur. Uh-oh, we've got a breech birth. We got foot first. We got butt first. All of those things related to fitting in and not fitting in are potentially a deadly problem. Potentially deadly for the mother, potentially deadly for the baby. And you know that the medical staff is going to be unbelievably anxious about that. So now all this fear is, welcome to the world, little baby. There were two branches of psychology that I'm really interested in. These are related to children, babies. One is, and they're both related to early life. One is called prenatal psychology. Prenatal psychology focuses on what is going on, what experiences are being had by the developing fetus, what the developing fetus is learning during that process. Going to be in that womb for 9 months. Is it learning? Is it just physically growing? What is going on? And this area of prenatal psychology is saying unbelievable amount of stuff is being learned from conception to birth. The second branch of psychology is called perinatal, P-E-R-I, natal, one word, psychology. And it deals with the experiences that are acquired during the birth process itself and immediately thereafter. So you can think, the energy exchange during these times have a huge subconscious and conscious impact on the child and its life from that point on. I mean, lots of stuff is shaped, lots of stuff molded in that 9 months and at birth and immediately after the birth. Because there's so much research going on in these two areas, they now know that the energies exchanged during the time of conception can traumatize the future child. So, if they, male and female, move into that experience lovingly, wonderful. If there's something else going on, they can be traumatized. So if there's violence or force or unwillingness that are present during that act, the child can end up with certain unwelcomed personality traits. How about masochism, hostility, hatred, self-derision, and the list can go on. Now you'd think, we're about to make a baby. This is unbelievably important. It's more than just a physical activity. It's unbelievably important to the end result of this production cycle. It's unbelievably important to the baby. Now, some cultures are aware of that. They understand that conception is no small thing. It's not just a mechanical activity. It's huge. In India, there are certain traditions that are still used today in which the conception is planned and can be planned for up to a couple of years in advance, during which time the mother-to-be is going, you know what, I am preparing my womb, my body, I'm cleansing myself, I'm trying to make this body to be the perfect place. She's trying to purify her womb so it can be a pure home for the developing baby. That makes perfect sense to me. Doesn't it to you too? And the father, to be in this scenario, is working on himself with mantras and rituals as well, cleansing his own mental state in preparation for the conception. So now you have two, I'll say, highly aware beings, if not enlightened beings, that are going to combine their energies that are going to contribute to the creation of a third being. Wow, that's the way we all ought to be doing it. But there are lots of other things going on. Some of the studies that have to do with these branches of psychology have recognized this idea. That, and then they used the 9/11 experience in New York City when the World Trade Centers were hit by planes. They recognized that a lot of people were experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that event. Makes perfect sense. They also recognized that there was a whole field of pregnant women that could be studied. And they did. They studied these women. They knew of about 1,700 of them, where they were in the pregnancy cycle, you know, what month they were in, and they started to look at that. They could see that at the end of it, 1 year later, they recognized that a lot of these women had post-traumatic stress disorder. And when their babies were born, there was a genetic marker that indicated a predisposition to PTSD. Like, whoa. Now, a certain level of stress is absolutely necessary for the development of us, and some of it, moderate stress, will help our brains develop, kind of like, oh, I got to get ready for the game of life. But overwhelming levels, not that good. Underwhelming, really low levels, then we have a less developed, because there's nothing to get ready for in a case like that. Interestingly, in other research that was done, and I like this idea of language. It always impresses me when I speak to a European. One of the first things I will do is ask them how many languages they speak, because it fascinates me that people can speak 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 languages. I just think that is the coolest thing on the planet. But this idea that babies learn their mother tongue while they're still in the womb. Language training begins in the womb. So this was cool, that they did studies in which there was a baby born in France, and French being the normal language, that baby in a room, when French was being spoken, the baby would turn toward the French speaker. But a Russian baby, a baby born in Russia with Russian-speaking parents, when Russian was spoken, it would turn in that direction, toward the Russian, not toward the French. It was like, And they recognized all kinds of things, to include that the intonational, rhythmic, and vocabulary qualities of the mother tongue has been detected even in premature babies before they were 26 weeks old, they were born, that when they cried in the fashion, in the tonality that was normal to their language. Food preferences developed in the womb. Babies learn what they like based upon what the mother eats. And so when the mother changes what she's eating upon the baby being born, it's like, I'm not drinking this mother's milk. This doesn't have the right flavor and the right energy. And when they recognize that they use the selection process, the baby will gravitate toward the mother's milk that is similar in energy content that what they would have experienced while they were in utero. I find this to be important here. Not that any of this is unimportant in my opinion. That the emotional world, according to the research, is affected greatly during the 4th, 5th, and 6th months of pregnancy. That's the time when the brain structures are being developed and differentiated most effectively and most accurately, those brain structures that are dealing with emotions. Here's a quote I want to read from a Dr. David Chamberlain. He sums this idea up. Life in the womb is extremely active and interactive. Our ability to learn is inherent from even before birth. Our first abode, the womb, is in fact a classroom. So now the question becomes, what else did we pick up or learn in the womb during birth and immediately after? Of course, we learned our language when we know our food preferences and maybe a general awareness of safety or threat or physical characteristics that are, hey, I got the same race as my parents. Hey, I look like my parents. Yep, I got it. But what about other things that are taught to us? The energy patterns that are delivered to us by our parents and maybe by other adults. It makes sense to question what our mothers were most concerned about for themselves, for their families, and for the next child, us. What attitudes did they have about the time available to care for this child? The money enough to provide for this child, the desire to, even the desire to care for this child, the sense of being up to the challenge of motherhood, not an easy job, and I don't have to tell any mothers this, the degree that they want or didn't want that child, their willingness or ability to love this child, or were they viewing it as a burden or a threat, and maybe the fact that they were pregnant, you know, their own belongingness, how did they fit into their family, into their society, into the life that they foresaw for themselves, and their capabilities to handle all these responsibilities. And that list could go on and on. We could now look at our lives just through the framework of the 12 worlds, right? Spiritual, mental, emotional, physical, family, financial, career, social, leisure, community, political, maintenance, and say, let's compare our 12 worlds today to how we see our parents' 12 worlds. We could also narrow it down if we wanted to by looking at the date of our birth and then calculating the 4th, 5th, and 6th months of our pregnancy. Just looking at those 3 months specifically for our parents and what was happening at that time of the year, in the world, in the country that they were in, could give us a great number of clues as to the cellular memories that we want to heal. So we may have been programmed at birth, but it might be time for us to do some debugging of that programming. I'd like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. If our parents knew that sentence and lived by that sentence, our programming would have been completely different. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.